Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
January 13th, 2016, episode number 88, Fields of Peril. Hey, it's 2016. Where did that come from? Yeah. It's been a while since I've sat behind the microphone, but so many things have gone on. I don't know about you, but we take a little bit of a break during the holiday season from work. I try to schedule a lot of vacation days and have just been heads down in all the things domestic. Trip to New York City for a play, took in a Devils game during the holiday season, married my sister and my new brother-in-law. Got ordained as a minister online somewhere. I don't want to say it's a fly-by-night system, but it's rather unusual, and performed a wedding ceremony. That's a first. Check that off the bucket list, even though it was never on there. And this is the time of year, I don't know about you, where Sharon brings down the pile of bills and paperwork and information that she's collected all year but squirreled away in a desk drawer. And I go through and purge all the paperwork and replace it with the bank statements and the electric bills and update the Quicken with all of our financial stuff and make sure everything's on the straight and narrow. So yes, I've been pretty busy. And one of the things I did was work on a number of things for the podcast, but I won't give it away. You'll have to wait till the end of the episode to hear what's going on. Or perhaps you've been following on social media and you've seen some of the giveaways, the posts about this, but I'll just leave that as a teaser. So this is the time of year where I start to think beekeeping, because we have crossed into 2016 and spring is right around the corner, and I love this time of year. I love it. I love it for the passion that it is, where I can start to embrace what I'm going to do. I think about all those garage projects that I'm going to work on and finish before spring gets here. In fact, this weekend, Bob Kloss and I are going to try and get together and build a couple hive traps, and I'm going down the road to visit my neighbor, Jim. We're going to build a bee cage for the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association, and Santa brought me a book on Waray hives, and I still have my Waray hive out in the box, believe it or not. Sorry to the provider who gave it to me. But I didn't have any bees to put in it, but this year I will. And all those little projects that I want to do. And recently, I had the opportunity, as I do during the holidays, to build in some things I wanted to do. So I have some beeswax that I harvested, and I made lip balm. And in the upcoming Northwest meeting, I'm going to do a live demo of how to make lip balm. And I made a bunch of tubes to hand out to people as a parting gift for the demonstration. So I've been very industrious. And oh, yes, I did shoot a video of that. And yes, you will soon find that on the Northwest channel when I have a chance to put it up there. And speaking of that, yesterday I posted a David Tarpey video. I didn't think we got good footage of the second session that he had from the June meeting, but I went back through and painstakingly listened to the presentation and mapped to the best of my ability his slides to it. That was one of the disconnects, is I had the video footage, but I could not tell the cues of where the slides were. But listening to what he was talking about, I was able to put that together. So if you're interested in quality of commercial queens, visit youtube.com/NWNJBA, and you could watch that. Very proud of that. And a bunch of other videos that I put up over the break, so go check those out. So yeah, there's been a lot going on, and perhaps you have not been able to hear me behind the microphone in the podcast, but have been following by just knowing the outlets where I put my stuff out. So, excited about 2016, getting ready for my 2016 year objectives, which are very similar to last year with a couple flavors and changes. I feel so much better about the game plan going in, as I do every year. And so far, my bees are hanging on. I'll talk about that in a moment in the local hive report. But I guess first, we should tell you what we have in store here. So, Fields of Peril, the name of the episode, has to do with information that was released related to information coming out of Europe on a recent study that's very provocative, to the point where they are finding information about effects of neonicotinoids on insects where there shouldn't be any. And I'll lay that out and explain it to you. I don't want to go any further into that. Segment number two, bees. What do they do all day? We'll tell you some of their activities, specifically nurses versus foragers, in a study that we found. Segment number three, this is breaking right now. The EPA has released a preliminary pollinator assessment about the registration review for imidacloprid. This may be the story of the year this year, because it's finally going to give credence to the neonicotinoid conversation that we beekeepers have been entertaining since colony collapse disorder came to town. In the roundtable back half of the book, oxalic acid and Nozema, linkage for that, apiarymap.com, thriving or dying, a little bit of a quiz coming out of msn.com feature that we found. Follow that swarm, a little tip for you on how to figure out where your swarm is going. Mead making, gallon at a time, cool little blog post that we found that we'll do as a feature. I want to discuss, given that it's wintertime, winter feeding options, a short little expose on that, and where to find a resource. And then the breaking news about the Beekeeper Corner that's coming at the end, roundtable number seven. That's what we have in store, but you know, before we dive into all that, let's first go to the local hive report. Local hive report, one hive on the property, still good to go. That's good news. Actually, there's one in a something on the property. Get to that in a second. I've had a number of warm days. One day was almost 70 degrees, if not above it. Record highs here in New Jersey and in the New York, Pennsylvania area. The bees have been flying on all these days, and from what I could see, the hives are still fat and heavy, happy. That also includes the two hives that I have over at the church. Stopped in and looked at them less than a week ago on a warmer day, warmish day. I want to say it was 55 degrees and both of them were flying. Not a ton of activity, but enough to show that the hives are still going strong. So there's nothing more to report there. I did not put insulation on these hives. I went to Home Depot to buy the insulation and found out that the way that you buy it, it's too big, it wouldn't fit in my truck. I didn't have my trailer with me. When I say truck, I drive a RAV4. I don't drive a true pickup. And I don't think I could fit that panel in there, and I'm certainly not going to strap it to the roof, although maybe I could, I don't know. So one of these days when I get a chance, I'll hook up the trailer and drive it over. I'm due to go pick up some lumber for some projects soon, so I probably will kill two birds with one stone. Fact of the matter is it hasn't been too warm or too cold, so it's only now that you might benefit strongly from insulation. But still have that in the back of my mind to possibly tackle that. So three hives, all doing okay. Fourth hive was that small box that I pulled out and put in the observation hive, which is sitting in the gray room in my house. You know, that hive has been sitting in there. I've been watching it through the holiday season. It's been doing okay. It started out with a maybe smaller than grapefruit size, and it dwindled down to about a softball size, somewhere between a softball and a baseball. And you know, when it gets to be that size, it's hit and miss as to whether or not it'll make it to, and make it to spring and make it through winter. And unfortunately, the news is that they're down to a handful of bees, and they're not going to make it. I don't know what happened this past week. So one of the things is, while it's an observation hive, I don't like to leave them out in the light. And the observation hive has glass panels made of plexiglass, but it also has I don't know the name of the product, what you call it. It escapes me at the moment, but things that you cover that cover them off and leave them in the dark. So the other day I slid those off and looked, and what was a half face of a comb full of bees has dwindled down to a handful, 20, 30, with the queen sitting right in the middle. So I had a notion about this. Why did this hive not survive? Well, one of the things is I fed them, and that was a red flag right away. They didn't take any of the food. And not once did I see any of the bees eating any of the honey or pollen that was available to them. They were all just standing there milling around the queen. And the key was the queen didn't do anything. She was just being fed, groomed, whatever she was doing. Now, on flight days, they were going out, but I didn't see them bringing things back in. On my other hives, I saw them on flight days, a couple of them, bringing pollen back. Where they're finding it, I don't know, but they always find pollen during the winter. Not a surprise to me. So this is the interesting side of it, is not one egg laid by the queen, no activity to support the colony. And while they seemed to be warm enough in the house, bees were dwindling and dying. And so I think back to the origin of this queen. Where did it come from? It came from the June meeting. These were the queens that I purchased for that meeting to fly in the balloon to do the drone congregation area piece. And I have to go back and look at my notes. I don't think I took good notes, but I think this is the actual queen we flew that day. Or maybe it wasn't. I don't remember. But it would stand to reason that if it was the queen we flew, maybe we damaged it. Because remember, somewhere along the day, the queen fell from the balloon and landed in a tree. It was a pine tree. It probably nestled it great. But so anyway, this queen never laid an egg. Maybe it was doomed from the beginning. Whatever the case may be, this hive is kaput. Sorry to say it. Kills me to say it. It was cool while I had it, but the fact of the matter is, it's pretty much done. Now, what I want to do with this is, I suppose at some point in the next week or so, if this queen succumbs, I'll take her out and see if I can encapsulate her or make a queen pheromone elixir out of her so she doesn't completely go to waste. I don't know. I did that project last year, probably about this time, where I encapsulated it in resin. And I still have some of that. And this queen is beautiful. It's marked. So maybe that's the right thing to do with her. So at least she doesn't go completely to waste. So three hives and one pending DOA of an observation hive, which is frustrating, but probably not wholly unexpected. That's the local hive report. Bad note to end on, but good note that the other three are coming. I think usually when we get to about February 15th, Valentine's Day, that's when you declare victory, that we get through winter, and that seems to me to be right around the corner. So I'm really excited the fact that my hives are hanging in there. That's good news. All right, let's go to segment number one and get this thing started. Segment number one, I call this one Fields of Peril. A study was released recently that took on one of the nagging questions about reconciling testing of pesticide exposures to bees in the field versus what scientists, researchers could try in lab experiments. RFID, or radio frequency identification, has been used to track bee behavior and determine if specific individuals are impacted upon feeding laced substances. Therein lies the rub, however. If a researcher is concocting a potion of food and pesticide in a laboratory, is that functionally equivalent to what would happen on the rolling hills of your local municipality? I know of a study that was conducted and published in the journal PLOS ONE from 2012 that attached RFID chips to bees and then provided food with clothianidin and imidacloprid. The results of that study were that the sublethal exposure negatively influenced foraging behavior and that repeated low doses can have, quote, effects on certain aspects of foraging behavior even if they did not have any significant effects on the number of feeder visits or on the total foraging time, end quote. Okay, this is probably not new news and something that we've spoken of in the past here on the podcast, but you know, there's that little nit that pops up from the retractors of this type of research that indicates real world conditions are different, that feeding bees pesticide-laced foods is not real world, and that researchers have it wrong. Well, now we have a study conducted out in the real world. A new study was posted in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B Publishing with the title, Reconciling Laboratory and Field Assessments of Neonicotinoid Toxicity to Honeybees. There are 10 authors cited on the article, and they all have European names, of which I'll likely do a poor job pronouncing, so forgive me if I don't run through them. I'll provide, of course, a link to the research in the show notes where you can review this. The premise of the research takes advantage of the situation in France where they've banned three common neonics, one of them being thiamethoxam. In this case, they were able to work with the government to plant pesticide-treated plants in an area where there shouldn't be any neonics and measure the result of what came back to the test colonies. So I said thiamethoxam. Mostly when beekeepers discuss neonics, they speak of other better-known products, such as the aforementioned clothianidin and imidacloprid, the other two banned substances in the European Union. Kevin Moment, these bans took place in 2013 and were for 2 years. Given that we're heading to 2016, I wonder if they'll be extended or what exactly will happen there. So thiamethoxam neonic, not one that rolls off the tongue, so what is it? From Wikipedia it says, thiamethoxam is a broad-spectrum systemic insecticide, which means it's absorbed quickly by plants and transported to all of its parts, including pollen. It acts to deter insect feeding on plants. An insect can absorb it in its stomach after feeding or through direct contact, including through its tracheal system. The compound gets in the way of information transfer between nerve cells by interfering with nicotinic acetylcholine receptors in the central nervous system and eventually paralyzes the muscles of the insects. Now that you have a little background, let's turn our attention to the featured research. It's interesting to note that systemic insecticides now represent 30% of insecticides used worldwide. Scientists have recognized that the gap has emerged between the results of toxicity assessments in the laboratory and the field. As I said earlier, artificial exposure in laboratory experiments typically consist of providing individuals with contaminated food and comparing relevant physiological and behavioral impacts against the healthy bees and measuring the deltas. This is how they came to use the LD50 range as a benchmark for the toxicity of the products being tested. LD50, as we've explained before, is a lethal dose before 50% of the test subjects succumb to whatever they're being exposed to. It is clear that neonicotinoids have been found to have sublethal effects on mobility, orientation, foraging, and learning in honeybees, but various attempts to do field exposures have been unfulfilling. Because of the differences in opinions on how effective the research has been conducted, measured, and specifically what I know about how much exposure can be generated in a real-world environment. If you plant an acre in the middle of 100 acres, does it make any sense to say that that's a legitimate experiment, for example? The study notes that, quote, without formal identification of deleterious effects in real field exposure conditions, policy decisions will remain controversial. And there is a lot of controversy about the EMEA banning of these neonicotinoids because of that fact. Well, I'm presupposing that, but I believe that to be true. A lot of people, especially the chemical companies, dispute the way that the research was provided to actually warrant the ban. And suffice it to say, people go on to note that there are various explanations put forward for the empirical mismatch between laboratory and field experiments.
Perhaps laboratory experiments could have been conducted at an exposure level much higher than would normally occur in the field. They don't know. Perhaps research has overstated the insecticide effects owing to acute rather than chronic exposure. And effects in the field may be compensated for the bees via their resilience. So colonies just compensate. Nobody could tell that it's worse than it is. That type of approach. It could go both ways. So talking about the experiment directly, it was conducted in France with special permission from the government. The group was able to plant oilseed rape treated with thiamethoxam for the research in an area where there is a prohibition of any neonicotinoid treatments. So based on my simple review of the map provided with the research article and my cross-reference on a map from the web, it seems to indicate that the experiment was conducted somewhere near Melle, M-E-L-L-E, I'm assuming I'm saying that correct, France. It's about halfway down from the top of the country and favoring the left side. They planted winter oilseed rape from seeds treated with thiamethoxam on a total of about 380 acres, that's 153 hectares in 2013, and approximately 330, which is 135 hectares equivalent, in 2014. So 2 years they ran the study in Melle, France. That's a pretty sizable chunk of land. 380 and 330 acres, respectively. It's not 10 acres in the middle of a 120-acre cornfield. So for the colonies for the studies, they had 17 standardized experimental colonies bred from sister queens, and they were set up in 10-frame date ant hives and monitored in the field for colony dynamics and state of health. Now, I have to stop here for a second and get something out of the way. They found a little surprise, and it's with imidacloprid. They had imidacloprid detection in the samples brought back to the real hives. When they started the experiment, they planned on monitoring the bees for thiamethoxam, but discovered that they were also being exposed to imidacloprid, which shouldn't have been there. Therefore, when they report in the studies the field exposure levels, it actually represents a gradient of combined exposure to both of these neonicotinoid products. Like the earlier study I mentioned, they track mortality using bees fitted with RFID technology. From the study, it said, in 2003, there was a breakthrough that modernized the work of Carl von Frisch. Scientists and researchers were able to track insects, ants, bees, etc., down to the individual by affixing RFID sensors to their bodies. If you're not familiar with these radio frequency IDs, they're used in primarily, a lot of people talk, they're in everything. If you have a car that when you turn the key and it doesn't turn on, unless you have the proper key, there's an RFID sensor in there. One of the more popular notions is that they're used to track packaging in warehouses. A whole pallet of packages rolls through some sort of beam and it reads it. And in this case, they're literally affixing a chip to a bee and they put a sensor across the entrance, and every time the bee comes and goes, it registers that they have arrived or have departed. For honeybees, they're equipped with a transponder glued to the center of the dorsal thorax in such a way that the movement of the wings is not hampered. And they had tags on 6,847 individual bees from the 17 different colonies. So in order to understand this, you have to know how they set the fields up and the field exposure percentage. The field exposure was an open field landscape with a few semi-natural elements and homogeneously scattered oilseed rape fields, which accounted for 8 to 10% of the total land cover. Said in a different way, they were spread around various locations in proximity to the fields planted with neonics so they would get a balance of forage, but to be sure they would be exposed to the special treatment fields. on three occasions within 1 week intervals during oilseed rape blooming, 200 returning honeybees were collected when entering their hive and narcotized with ether in a cage. One by one, their abdomens were gently pressed until the crop nectar contingent was regurgitated. These nectar samples were then pooled in an Eppendorf tube, or tubes, because they did multiple, to get an average value of neonicotinoid residual content per colony and sampling date. So they grabbed the bee, they squeezed, I'm guessing its honey stomach, had it regurgitate, took it all, collected it in a sample, and then took readings from them. And throughout the study, tagged honeybees were recorded as alive until the day following the last tag detection event. So let's talk about what they found. Thiamethoxam residues were found in dietary nectar brought back to the colonies by the foragers. It increased significantly with experimental field exposure, validating the field exposure design. However, they note, and to that surprise I mentioned earlier, they discovered an unexpected and substantial concomitant exposure to midacloprid in the dietary nectar samples. What they say was 0.1 to 1 part per billion in 13 of the 17 surveyed colonies. They found imidacloprid in combination with the thiamethoxam. So in France, imidacloprid is currently used as a seed dressing treatment for a range of crops not pollinated by insects, such as wheat, barley, sugar beet. But it's been prohibited from sunflower since 1999 and has never been used on oilseed rape. We'll speculate in a little bit where it came from. But continuing with their findings, honeybees disappeared at a faster rate with increasing field exposure, and this excess mortality increased over time. This might be interpreted either as a consequence of the accumulation of neonicotinoid residues in food and hive materials over time with a delayed effect, or as the emergence of chronic exposure effect. So that's interesting. It's a consequence of eating this more and more and having some sort of delayed effect, or being chronically exposed to it over and over and over again. They're not sure which. They confirmed that field exposure accelerated the disappearance of both forager and just-emerged bee cohorts, and it was 2.4 times higher for the foragers. You could hypothesize that when foragers die earlier, bees will have to be recruited to replace them sooner. Yes and no. They found that up to the 10th day of monitoring, 19.6% of the flights for young bees occurred earlier, but by the 20th day of monitoring, 8.8% of bees didn't go as expected, offsetting the early flight expectations. Speculation could be that someone had to stay behind to cope with the increasing nursing tasks and strains on colonies. So, a hive environment is a push-pull kind of thing. Foragers will go out and they'll come back and meet the receiving bees. Receiving bees will wait for foragers to return. As we've said in the past, if foragers don't return and receiving bees are just kind of sitting there, they'll press themselves into service. What they're saying here is they didn't see that happen, but possibly because somebody had to stay behind at some point and take care of the brood. Interesting finding there. They also noted during the study that there was an impact to the drone population. Drones are more common early in the season when there are virgin queens that require mating. Drones are more costly to produce, and they noticed a delay in drone brood development. Now, it's known that colonies decrease drone production when foraging conditions are poor from scarcity, but in this case, it was due to excess forager mortality. One could conceive that this could offset the balance of the colony in some ways. So I'll tell you the results in a moment, but I wanted to circle back to the imidacloprid. Where did it come from? They analyzed oilseed rape floral nectar samples from 82 oilseed rape fields in the study area, and it was mostly undetected in the nectar samples. They speculated that the substantial reuptake of residues came from wildflowers in the field margins. Various hypotheses may be proposed for those observations, including the persistence and accumulation of neonicotinoid residues in the soil throughout one or more annual crop succession cycles, their lateral movement and leaching in adjacent slopes, or even possible contaminations via the seed coating machinery. Now, how interesting is that? It takes us back to that episode where we discussed Hank Tinnakes and his thoughts on this stuff out all over the place in our environments. And let me give credit where credit is due. That notion was discussed from the podcast from Kiwi Mana Buzz, where Hank, H-E-N-K, not H-A-N-K, Tinnakes, T-E-N-N-E-K-E-S, discussed neonicotinoids, a disaster in the making book that he wrote with Gary from the Kiwi Mana Buzz. It was episode number 52, if you want to go check that out. KiwiMana.co.nz. Pretty good, huh, Gary? /henk-tennekes-km052, or just look up episode 52. I think you'll find it there. So let me get to the conclusion of this. The results, as they publish them, in this study, we found that individual honeybees near thiamethoxam-treated fields do indeed disappear at a faster rate, but the impact of this is buffered by the colony's demographic regulation response. They found that field exposure to thiamethoxam combined with concomitant imidacloprid contamination is associated with significant excess mortality in free-ranging bees. Colonies appear to be able to compensate for the excess mortality so as to preserve unaltered performance in terms of population size and honey production. Wow. I don't say wow much when it comes to this whole neonicotinoid thing. I've been waiting for this type of research. And, when you look at the various things, to me, it passes the sniff test. It was done in an area where it could be measured. It was done in an area where it was banned, so it's not like the product could have come from somewhere else. It was done with enough planting and enough space, the acreage, to make sense, I think. And maybe some scientist or researcher, Bayer, who knows, Syngenta will come back and do a counterpoint to this and change my opinions. But for right now, I think this is an extremely important research paper, one of the more important ones. And I surely hope that the EPA is looking at this and understanding what the impacts are. At some point, someone has to come back and look at these impacts and also the method by which we test these products and come up with a better system. If anything, this is another salvo in the argument for beekeeping and bees that these products are something of concern and need to be reviewed and handled properly. It's even more disconcerting to know that the stuff is in the environment as we expected it would be. And here's the proof. They're finding imidacloprid, which isn't supposed to be there. Someone will take this and extend it even further in the next 2 years, I'm sure, and the story will continue to mount, and you have to wonder about those DDT videos that they showed us in school, where they were driving down, spraying it across the parks and plants and things like that. Yeah. Anyway, check our show notes. You'll find the links to the two research articles that we brought in this segment. Segment number two, we call this one, What Do Bees Do All Day? Since I had an observation hive in the house, I had a short period of time to watch what the bees were doing. As you heard in the local hive report, it has dwindled and there's not much hope that anything's going to survive. There were only a handful of bees left, but You know, I've seen observation hives in various places, including the ones that we maintain at the fairs when we bring them for people to look at. And it's always fun to watch them work with the brood. It's fun to watch them eat, trophallaxis, other things that they have going on. In the case of my hive, they just milled around. They didn't seem to eat much. Nobody was really paying attention. The queen wasn't doing anything. That's what made me believe the thing was not functional in the first place. But whatever the case may be, watching the observation hive got me to thinking about what else I might observe and what exactly do bees do all day. Luckily, although I didn't see it in my hive, there's a summary that was available through a research paper, and it's a good reminder of the number of jobs that go on routinely in a colony. So that's where I'm going to go here in this segment. There was a study I found from 1995 where a team of researchers followed up on von Frisch's work from 1965 and did nothing but monitor a colony's activities day and night over a period of time. They put a colony in an incubator and coded them with tags for observation so that they could detect what they were doing in their daily routines. The observation group of bees were marked and observed with magnifying glasses and, if need be, flashlights. You know, with red lenses affected so they didn't disturb the bees, of course. The goal of this particular study was to test the variations of behaviors of nurses and foragers working during two sampling periods, the middle of the day and at night in full darkness. And specifically, they were trying to observe communications and exchange of food and food consumption and communications. I'll explain that later. They also made note of the activities that were being conducted in the brood chamber area or other areas of the observation hive. They introduced the bees into the colony at specific times so that they could track their ages, and the ones that were 7 to 12 days old were deemed to be the nurse bees because of the age bracket. So they groomed these bees on the side, they got them to specific ages, and then they melded them in there and counted them, and that way they knew they were counting bees of a certain age. To be clear about how they monitored the bees, they watched them at two key periods for durations of an hour and a half, or 90 minutes. Each observer watched one bee directly, and in the study they monitored four bees at a time for each observation period. That means four observers simply followed a single bee for 90 minutes and recorded what they did. Specifically, one thing they kept track of at 5-minute intervals was where the bee was in relation to the brood nest. Was it inside or outside of the brood nest area? And prior to the study, what they did was, on the glass of the incubation hive, they drew a boundary around what was considered to be the brood nest area so that it was clear it was either inside or outside of the boundary. So because part of the study was they were working with foragers, they only did the observations on days where there was active foraging. And then they monitored the bees on those days from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. That doesn't mean they monitored from 11 to 3. They monitored them in that window for 90 minutes. Could have been the front end or the back end. And then subsequently, they monitored the bees from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. Same thing, a window of opportunity. They did this 45 times or 45 sessions, and then they compiled all the results and came up with the outcome of the study. So I'm going to give, the way the study paper was written is that they broke it down first, that they agreed upon certain behaviors so that they would all describe them the same way. And then after, in the paper, they described the behavior activities that they saw related to what they agreed upon was an activity. In other words, let me give you an example. They all agreed what the definition of absolutely inactive means. And they explained that to you. I'm going to tell you. And then afterwards, they described which bees were absolutely inactive. You'll see in a second here. The reason I'm telling you this is in the research paper, they went through the definitions first, and then later they went and told you the results. I'm going to give it to you in a different way just to compact this all together. I'm going to tell you what the definition was that they were looking for and the result. The definition and the result. Got it? Then I'll wrap up with the insight of the observation and conclusions that they came to. And many of the notes that I'm going to give you are their direct words, observations, tweaked for presentation, or literally word for word their note observations. I'm relaying it to you in an audible sense, so therefore I can't read you what is written. It's portrayed differently. All right, enough of that intro. Let's go ahead and take a look at it. So, yeah, absolutely inactive. Their definition, the bee stays in an empty cell without detectable movements of the abdomen or sits motionless with immobile antennae. What they found? They noted a significant difference in this behavior between foragers and nurse bees during the day and night. While nurses were inactive for only a short period independent of time of day, foragers had long periods of inactivity during night and much fewer during the day. Next definition, idle, described as the bee sits and moves its antennae or legs, or walks with a velocity of less than 5 millimeters per second in no particular direction. Their finding? In nurses as well as foragers, they noted this behavior was evenly distributed during the day and night, though it was seen less often in the forager task group. The next activity they were looking for was patrolling. This is described as bees walks across the comb at a rate of about 5 to 10 millimeters per second. The results for both of them are foragers patrolled significantly more during the day than during the night, and nurses showed this behavior to be significantly higher proportion than foragers with no difference between day and night. Next activity, nursing brood. This is where the bee had its head inside a cell within the brood area for more than 5 seconds and its body moved. In most cases, the presence of larvae was also checked afterwards to be sure that this was a nursing activity. The result, independent of time of day, nursing by nurse bees lasted for 3% of the duration of the observation period. It was almost never observed in foragers. So that makes sense. Nurses nurse, foragers don't. Good. The next activity, trophallactic contacts, where bees donate and receive something from their mouth. It's described as one bee, a recipient, puts its tongue between the mandibles of another bee, the donor, for more than 2 seconds. There was a trend toward more trophallactic interactions during the day than during night for nurses. This was even more pronounced for foragers. Nurses donated food more often during daytime than during nighttime, but they received food at an equal rate during the day and night. Foragers donated food more often and were fed more often during the daytime than during night. Foragers received food more often than they donated food during the nighttime. Though the data showed that the same tendency for the daytime, this difference was not significant. Next activity, visiting pollen and honey cells. And in quotes, they had eating pollen and honey as the activity. This particular activity, my note, has more description than the other ones. And that stands to reason is this is one of the key reasons they took this work on in the first place. They were trying to figure out how much pollen and honey were eaten. So they described the activity boundaries that were labeled for this activity as the worker inserts its head into a cell containing pollen or honey for more than 2 seconds. For this observation, they assumed, without actual proof, that the bees were consuming honey or pollen. For each individual bee observed to eat pollen, the mean duration of the visits to the pollen cells was calculated. The mean duration of visits of all bees was then calculated from this data. Those Observation periods in which bees never were seen to visit pollen cells were not taken into account for calculation of mean duration. The procedure was the same for visiting honey cells. This means the daily frequency of consumption was calculated by a formula, and I'll give it to you. All observation events with bees inside pollen and honey cells times 24 hours divided by the duration of period all bees could be located. For this estimation, they counted all feedings within one observation period as an event. Okay, so with that behind us, this is what they found. Nurse bees often visited honey cells during the day and night. For example, in approximately 30% of observed periods, but foragers were never seen in honey cells. Nurses or foragers were very seldom seen in pollen cells. For this study, the forager never consumed pollen during the investigation period. I think we'll talk about that a little later, or I'll remember to come back and talk about my thoughts there. In general, what I'm going to say to you is, I don't think foragers need to eat what's inside the hive because they're getting stuff outside, but we'll come back to this. I do find it interesting that foragers never consumed pollen. Now, how does that work? Do they eat pollen outside? Yeah. Okay, again, we'll come back to this. One last observation one is wax manipulation, simply described as observation of wax of brood caps or cells on the frames was manipulated in any way. You can guess what the story is for this one. Nurses showed this behavior during day and night. Foragers never did. So, of course, there's other activities going on inside the hive. And they describe these as various activities, including flight and dancing and the things that you know take place. Their observation was, both day and night, nurses spent nearly 20% of the observation time upon other activities than those that I just went over. But in the study, they didn't bother to spell them out because, again, they were mostly concerned about feeding-type activities. That's what they were trying to watch for. Foragers, on the other hand, of course, performed many flights during the daytime, which resulted in a significant difference in their activity patterns between day and night. They were out flying all day, you could say. But additionally, foragers also showed a significant difference between day and night when foraging was not considered. Again, they didn't call these out as they were looking for in-hive duties, not what they were doing outside. So let's talk about the observations overall. And I'm just going to go through like a bulleted list here of things, no particular order. First one is observed foragers were very inactive at night, staying mostly in the lower part of the hive and clinging to a quiet cluster of bees. Kevin commentary, I would have expected this, right? Foragers are out working all day and they have to rest at night. Bees are what they call dynural. They have two parts to their life cycle. We've covered this before on the podcast. In the beginning, they work kind of 24 hours a day with taking cat naps in between. And then once they switch to a foraging state, they become night and day. Think human-esque. They sleep at night and they work all day. So foragers, again, this is my conjecture, were found to be less active at in-hive activities than nurse bees. Duh, that's what you would expect. Observation from them, the two task groups, nurses and foragers, exhibit different day and night rhythms. For compelling reasons, likely to the exposure of light and darkness, foragers show very little rhythmic behavior, expressed primarily in flight activity. In addition to this, however, they've shown that in other activities and in their location inside the hive, they depend on That depends on the time of day. So food collection during the day, a very energy-consuming task which limits lifespan, is followed by resting during the night, similar to what I just echoed a moment ago. Nurses, on the other hand, are influenced by time of the day only in their effort to donate food by trophallaxis. An activity in you know, in which at least one more rhythmic task group, the foragers, is involved. In their observation, the primary duty of nurse bees, brood care, was not influenced by daytime. They did it day and night. So it's been an interesting mix comparing nurse or house bees against foragers and learning the tasks and difference about how they go about things. Not a tremendous amount of surprise, but a couple of neat little tidbits in there. If you want to review the additional data that accompanied the study, check out our show notes, episode 88, segment number 2, and you can find a link to the research article. The name of the study was Dynural Behavior Differences in Foragers, Forager and Nurse Honeybees. It was by Kralsheim, Rasnig, and Stabenthiner. Yeah, probably murdered those. It's out of France, if you're curious. And again, you can find a note in our show notes. Segment number 3. I'm not typically an alarmist when it comes to neonicotinoids, but this time you get a double salvo. To follow on with segment number 1, this one's called EPA Preliminary Pollinator Assessment to Support the Registration Review of Imidacloprid. This is something that's been ongoing, and the premise of this particular segment is that the U.S. EPA, Office of Chemical Safety and Pollutant Prevention, released a 305-page memo that updates a December 11, 2015 assessment with editorial comments on the executive summary and corrections of studies that are contained therein. Yep, okay, that's a description of the thing, from the thing. Given it's a 305-page document of technical and analytical data, it's too early for me to weigh in with any meaning as to exactly what it says, but I came across this particular news article from something published by author Tom Philpott, a writer from the website MotherJones.com, which is a self-described nonprofit news outlet that delivers bold and original award-winning reporting on the urgent issues of our day, from politics and climate change to education and the food we eat. So given that tag, you can kind of understand its slant. And his headline for this particular story reads, "The EPA finally admitted that the world's most popular pesticide kills bees 20 years too late." So I'll provide a link to that, but I'm going to go the conservative route here and let everyone finish reporting on this particular memo and its subsequent memos. But when you look at the memo, there are, on first blush, a number of items and insights put forth our direction that the EPA is coming around to the notion that neonics require further study and evaluation. How about that for an insight after all this time? So I've always had this stance that I wanted the science to come out, and I wanted the EPA to look at the science and irrefutably have no choice but to address it, and that day seems to be coming. I suspect it'll take a few weeks to digest what was in this memo and the subsequent memos that are coming after it. But it alone discloses a good number of interesting facts on the pervasiveness of imidacloprid. And for me personally, some things that struck a nerve, things that are close to home for me, how much it permeates the soybean industry. And I'll tell you why that's an interest to me. Because along with soybeans and corn and hay fields, soybeans is, if not, one of the most prevalent crops in my region. Within the 5-mile fly radius of my hives, there are soybean fields all over the place. And that's an interesting facet, because here's one little ditty from the memo. Screening level usage information provided by the screening level usage analysis, referred to in the memo all the way through as SLUA. You have to know what the term is, because it's everywhere in the memo. It's noted to not include all the potential uses of seed-treated application for imidacloprid, but it does indicate that soybeans dominate the seed-treated application usage with 400,000 pounds applied annually. This represents the largest use of imidacloprid in terms of poundage applied from all the use patterns delineated in the SLUA, or the level usage analysis. So it goes on to say the sources for the screening level usage analysis include the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, NAS, which reports data from 2004 to 2013. Private Pesticide Market Research, reporting data from 2004 to 2013. And the CDPR pesticide use reporting data, which is reported from a period of 2004 to 2012. So in contrast to the soybean poundage, cotton, which is a major concern for exposure based on things that I know, had 50,000 pounds applied per year, and potatoes had 30,000 pounds. It might make you think differently as you drive past the acres and acres of soybean fields in your area. I know as I drive down my road, I will think differently from now on. So while I said this thing is pages and pages and pages, I read through a few sections, and it's going to take a while to parse what it had to say, as you have to read it for meaning, and it's complicated, jargon-laden, statistic-laden, figure-laden, so on. But I thought I'd call it out, as it's hot off the presses, and you're going to find some disturbing things in there. The one section discusses exposures to bees, and it's rife with commentary about how detrimental it is to bees. Of particular interest to me is the section that discusses some of the water solubility findings. I'm hoping they have some information in there that is of personal interest when reviewing this topic, going back to the Hank Tenneke's thing that I mentioned earlier. I did note on several sections that they called out left and right the problems, but indicate that there's insufficient data to know conclusively on the topics being reviewed. So throughout, it said, this is a concern, this is something we need to look at, this is whatever, but there's inconclusive data. So the things that they do know, they're concerned about, and the things that they don't know, that's inconclusive data, they're calling out here because they probably need to do the math on it. There's a lot of work to be done. So case in point to the soybean discussion I said a moment ago, it says, quote, soybeans represent an uncertainty in the risk profile because its major use pattern is attractive to bees via pollen and nectar. Yet pollen and nectar data are unavailable from both registrant and open literature sources, end quote. So perhaps Tom Philpott is right. It's 20 years too late, but just a few short years ago, no one was doing anything about the problem, so we have that going for us, to quote a line from Caddyshack. So not to make light of it, but, you know, again, this is where we were waiting for the science to come through and the EPA to catch up, and that day has come, it appears. This is the first of four preliminary reports on neonicotinoids, and it seems there'll be public comments, and you could sign up for email alerts on their website to be automatically notified when the agency opens the public comment period. So my guidance to you, stay tuned. I'm sure there'll be much more to do about this one. There'll be sensationalism, the BBC, the Huffington Post, TMZ, who knows? Everybody will pick up on this. It'll become a worldwide story. And it's only the beginning of the noise of the public coming back to this. You have to wonder whether they'll villainize this so much that they'll declare victory on CCD. One of the things we've talked about in the past is that's a concern. But whatever the case may be, our day has come to discuss this. So look in the show notes for a link to Tom Philpott's original article that I stumbled across, and a link to the memo, Imidacloprid Registration Review, which that page also includes, I think it's on the upper right-hand corner, the public comment link where you can click on and sign up for that. So let's go to roundtable number one. Roundtable, if you're new to the podcast, is the area where we just talk about odds and ends. It's the back of the book, so to speak. This one's called Oxalic Acid and Nozema. I'm going to make a prediction that oxalic acid will become the darling Varroa treatment this year. The momentum for it becoming the next best thing is starting to grow. So here in New Jersey, it's slow going, as unlike our neighbors to the north and our friends the Kiwis and others, we don't have practical experience with it in the U.S. Recently approved for use in the U.S., I'll make it clear that it is not approved yet in New Jersey, in case you want to experiment. But I suspect, however, that all of the articles I see popping up in the mainstream press will create momentum, and New Jersey will have to take a hard look as an option for treatments here. One such article about about oxalic acid is a recently called out UC Davis newsletter on the fact that it might not only be good on Varroa, but it could also provide the added benefit of taking down Nozema. So, Nozema has been an enigma, one of those things, Nozema serrani, and the treatments using traditional treatment stuff is not effective, and it kills Nozema only for it to come back stronger and all these other things. So it's an interesting side effect that oxalic may potentially have this, and we can step away from the fumigelin. European researchers showed that analysis of individual bees after colony treatments with oxalic acid showed lower prevalence of Nozema, and colonies demonstrated a greater survival when checked in the spring. So if true, what's not to love about that? Now, as the newsletter points out, it's not registered for use, so let's not get ahead of ourselves and have patience, and our patience will be rewarded. The article on the European study can be found at the sciencedirect.com website. Seek out volume 102 from October 2015. You're looking for pages 167 to 172. The article title is called, quote, Effect of Oxalic Acid on Nozema serrani Infection, end quote. And one last footnote to share with you. The UC Davis newsletter is one of the best out there. If you're not subscribed, you are missing out. Roundtable number two, apiarymap.com. My son, Danny, found and shared this website with me recently. Given the title, I bet you can guess what you could find here. The notion of the website is for you to learn what other beekeepers have in your area. If you and your neighbors add your bees, you'd be able to see what's in your vicinity and tell the race of bees you have if they disclose that information. Another side benefit is that you can list if you have honey for sale and information about your website and phone number. In my county, for example, Bee and Jean-Claude Tassot have Tassot apiaries listed in their information card, including comments that welcome to you to their store and bee farm. I guess I personally have one reservation, sorry apiary map, for raining on the parade, and that is that my yards are somewhat obscure to the public, and this would make them easily discoverable. Now, I can't say that I've ever once heard of anyone having hives stolen or messed with in my vicinity, but these things are always in the back of our minds when it comes to the investments in our colonies. And having a hives are here map kind of makes me a little squeamish. So I guess I'm going to have to think on this, and perhaps I'll simply throw caution to the wind and put my stuff in there, hard to tell. When I publicly talk on the subject, you might be surprised to know
that I'm somewhat conservative when it comes to disclosures. What's my business is my business. Call it security through obscurity. So anyway, there are some 4,000 plus apiaries registered there, and ones are being added every day. You could check that out at apiarymap.com. Roundtable number three, this one's called Thriving or Dying. There was a feature in the main rotator on MSN.com recently that caught my eye. It had a note of 25 industries that are thriving and 25 industries that are dying. The reason it caught my eye, surprisingly, is the lead article image was a beekeeper holding a frame of bees. So yes, one of these industries was apiculture. So what's your guess? Is it thriving or dying? I'll give you a moment to reason out your answer. Okay, made your guess yet? The answer is, drum roll please, thriving. How about that? According to statistics, beekeeping employment growth from 2005 to 2014 was surprisingly a 97% uptake. Almost doubled. Average annual employment growth was 7.8%. Now, here's a funny footnote in my mind. The average wage was around $35,000. And the reason it's funny is that's not a lot of money in my area. And keep in mind that I live in the East Coast, expensive area near New York City. It costs a lot to live here. Taxes are ridiculous. Maybe if you live somewhere else in the United States, not on the East Coast or West Coast, but somewhere in the middle, $35,000 gets you by. I don't know. I don't have any practical experience and don't plan to dig myself a hole here. So let me just keep going. Anyway, it says that, quote, to identify the dying and thriving industries, 24/7 Wall Street reviewed employment growth from 2005 through last year. For 596 U.S. industries in the fourth level of detail in the North America Industry Classification System by the U.S. Census Bureau, end quote. So a couple notes. Employment in the apiculture industry has nearly doubled over the past decade. Apiculture, which primarily consists of raising bees, collecting and gathering honey, and facilitation of the pollination of fruits and nut crops, has grown from 1,515 U.S. employees in 2005 to 2,984 in 2014. So let's just take that number in itself. There are 2,984 registered full-time employees doing apiculture for a living. I guess when you think about how many people it takes to run an operation or whatever, that makes sense. Seems like a reasonable number. The next point of interest was industry wages grew modestly in the same period, with the average income of apiculture employee growing from $26,572 in 2005 to $35,550 in 2014. The 33.8% wage growth was slightly higher than the 31.1% wage growth of the average American worker. So in the top 25 industries in the United States, from a growth standpoint, according to that report, apiculture checked in at number 7, and that's pretty cool. Links in the show notes. Roundtable number 4, this one's called Roundtable Tip, Follow That Swarm. Our most popular post on the Northwest YouTube channel is about hiving a swarm with a vacuum, courtesy of Bob Kloss. It has some 94,000 views, and as such, gets a lot of comments. Somewhere this video got posted to a teenage forum, or a place where adolescents roam, as you could sense
the maturity from the responses, the comments to the video. Some amusing, some show the trouble of America, but that's not what this segment's about, so I'll leave it there. What is cool about most of the comments is that there are some often insightful questions and tips about beekeeping, and one such came from a commenter on how to follow a swarm if you happen to be fortunate to be in the midst of an emerging cloud of bees. The tip? Sprinkle flour in the air on the bees swarming from the hive, and you'll have a white trail to follow the swarm. That's pretty ingenious. I can envision Kevin standing out in the yard with a bag of flour, throwing it in the air as the bees are flying around so I could follow him across the cornfield. I love that idea, and someday, somewhere, I'm going to have to remember it and give it a try. So, commenter James Wilson, if you're out there, thanks for that tidbit. It made our day. Roundtable number 5, this one's called Mead Making. Anyone? There are a good number of websites out there for the DIY person when it comes to areas of interest like home projects, maker projects, and especially cooking. I have grown fond of those short, simple videos that you see on Facebook that give you a couple easy steps to make a no-fuss food item. And typically when you click on those, they take you to these boutique blogs that people put where they share with a little candor a process by which you make something with photos that go along the way. I think this is the new version, the modern version of the millennial cookbook, so to speak. So the Grow Forage Cook Ferment website is authored by a nice lady named Colleen, no last name. Presumably it's not disclosed for anonymity reasons. And as a side note, and please don't think I'm being sexist about this, but every mead making article I have ever seen has been from a dude. So mead making, beer, universally, everything you look up on the web, it's not typically a female, so I thought this was unique, and I had to give her props for that. Anyway, as I said, it has simple step-by-step procedure of what you need to make a gallon of mead, and my guess is it's a presentation of a good first indoctrination to the topic, and along the way, she smatters in what mead is and how it came about, and tips and tricks of how to get success without a lot of muss and fuss. What's cool about it is it'll take you through your first adventure, and then at the bottom you can see that she has explored even further, and she provides the next instruction set, which is how to make a 5-gallon batch. And you can figure out how to make wildflower mead, elderberry mead, or simply browse the other stuff that she has authored. So one thing I will suggest as a tip is while you're looking at the procedure, finish that and then go down and read the comments below. I will warn you about that thing that I loathe and have bemoaned about before. Yes, there's a bunch of trolls in there that say this doesn't work, this da-da-da. But for the most part, there are a lot of good-natured comments, and some offer additional guidance and insights that you might want to consider, including additional clarifications from the author on questions put forth by the commenters of her blog. So give it a look-see. Here's the web address for you. All one word. growforagecookferment.com and then a slash and then type in how-to-make-a-gallon-of-mead. It's all spelled out with dashes, not spaces. And I know that was a little goofy. growforagecookferment.com, how to make a gallon of mead with dashes in between. Or simply go to our show notes and click on it. Roundtable number 6, winter feeding options. It's a time of year to replace last year's calendar with a fresh one. I'm talking about the New Jersey Beekeepers Association calendar. The January one is out. If you haven't got one, get one. For me, I replaced my NJBA 2015 calendar with this year's model, but I'm certainly not going to discard it. In fact, I've kept the one from 13, 14, and now 15. I'll remind you that if you have one hanging around, make sure you look at the back for the information provided. I know a lot of people, when I said this to them, they're like, oh, that's back there? I didn't even know. There's so much good insight and tips shared at the end, and I want to share one with you. On the last pages of the calendar, there are recipes for how to feed bees in the winter, if that's an interesting topic. So it has tips for providing loose sugar and other forms of feed that can be used in the winter. Fondant, heavy syrup. There are recipes for made-in-the-hive bee candy, no-cook bee candy, and hard sugar candy in small and large batches. So let me give the large batch recipe. Mix 5 1/3 cups of water with 20 pounds of sugar in a large restaurant pot. Cook it until it gets 240 degrees Fahrenheit, which incidentally is the top temperature for the candy softball stage and almost enters into hard crack. You really want to be careful when handling this hot molten liquid. Pour it into molds of your choice and just simply let it cool. If you want a smaller batch, here's the ratio. 1.5 cups of water in a large pot. To that, add 8 cups of sugar. Boil it, and then reduce it to a slow boil and continue to stir it, making sure it won't burn, because if you just leave it sit in there, the bottom will burn to your pot. You cook this too at 240 degrees Fahrenheit and then pour it in some disposable pie tins that'll give you a shallow block of sugar that you can put in your hive and still fit the lid on top of it. So when it comes time to place it in your hive, set some paper towels on the top bar 1 inch from the rear of the hive and put it in on top of that. Consider leaving a 1/2 inch shim under your inner cover to leave room for the bees to access it if you're a little tight in there, depending on your type of equipment. And it'll serve two purposes. It'll feed the bees, and sugar is hygroscopic, so it will absorb some excess moisture if that's the case. So there you go. Check out the 2015 calendar in the back before you discard it for these sugar recipes. And incidentally, the New Jersey Beekeepers Association has the 2016 calendar for sale on their website. And I don't think you need to live in New Jersey to buy one. So go give that a look. It's njbeekeepers.org for the website. My guess is you could find a link on the homepage. I'm not sure about that. I'll have to check. So I know that we are past the hour mark, and this is when I usually try to shut things down, but I have one more round table, and I've saved the best for last. This one's called BK Corner Website. So you may have noticed that I took a little bit of a break over the holidays. I was actually set to record this episode on New Year's Eve. Had everything going and woke up that morning sick and had laryngitis. What's funny is I had recorded segment one sometime about the 20th or 25th of December and had to wait till January here to be able to find the time to get back behind the microphone. So during that downtime, I've been on a bit of a sabbatical, but I have been very industrious. One of my efforts that I'm proud to announce is the new website is finally online. I went through the drudgery of getting things switched over, and while I have a few warts to take care of, I really couldn't be happier with the outcome. I like the way it looks. It's so much easier to post content. It's still a lot of work, don't get me wrong, but it looks so much better. And for you, the end user, I'm hoping that it's easier to find stuff. It's categorized a little better. And just simply the presentation is more pleasing to the eye. The old one was a study in what not to do. So my hopes are that with the more blog-like experience that this new website provides, I'll be able to provide more information in between shows and better information about the things that I present. So I'll present continually the show notes, but the subsegments, if I have more information about those, I could share them in individual posts. And a lot of times when I do these things, go out on a jaunt, talk about some activity, I have pictures and other media to share with it. And I think I could be a little more forthcoming with the information and get you more engaged. The other thing that I really am excited about is all the videos that I've been shooting that accompany. I keep referring you over to the SharePoint, wow, that's a work faux pas, to the YouTube channel. And now I can post the links and information in the video directly at my site. So it's a one-stop shop. Don't keep going to YouTube if you want, but you'll see there's a video section. Most of the time what I'm going to try to do there is post the stuff that I generate directly. All the other content that I shoot for Northwest, interviews with people, presentations that I capture for our club and others and whatever, will continue to be there. So don't forget Northwest's YouTube, youtube.com/NWNJBA, but keep a lookout on our site for videos that we have. One such video is I just recently made a batch of lip balm following Landy Simone's recipe and shot a feature on that, and I'll have that posted in short order. So finally, the day has come. Our new website is up. Go over and take a look at it and say hello. I'm really excited about that. One thing that I ask is that I've gone blind looking at everything that got posted, 100-something posts over there. Be kind, but if you see something wrong, just send me a note, kevin@bkcorner.com. I know there's some warts, but if you see things that are broken, links that don't work, whatever, just kindly drop me off a note and I will put them on the pile and go back and fix them. I'm not expecting you to find a lot of stuff, but if you do, I'd be happy to take your feedback on that. So there you go. The Beekeeper's Corner podcast has an official new website, and it looks really sharp. So it seems a good time as any to close out the episode. I wanted to say that I will begin recording again with a little more cadence. I shoot myself in the foot every time you say that, but I have a little secret. I know for a fact what's going to happen in the next episode because I have already written some of the content for it. The feature will be about pheromones in detail. Pretty interesting. And I wrote this with the intention of putting it in here, but it grew to its own monster. And I left it out of this, and I'm going to make it the main feature of our next episode, episode number 89. And I have a whole host of other things in the queue. So I'm really ready to go, and maybe even this weekend. I'm recording here on a Tuesday night. I will put that together. So keep posted for the next installment of the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Before I close out, I wanted to say I have a figurative string tied around my finger so I didn't forget something. Had a conversation with Bob Kloss the other day, and he was telling us at our executive meeting something interesting that I thought I'd pass along. It has been an extremely warm winter. November was ridiculously warm. December was warm. We finally got some cold air, and even today is the first day I've seen snow on the ground. And Bob said he's been checking his hive, and what he noticed from a weight standpoint, and what has traditionally been the case, even though it's warm and everybody's concerned that their bees are consuming a lot of food, the hive has dropped a pound a week. Same pattern as last year when it was ridiculously cold. That's an interesting observation, and I'm not telling you not to feed your bees and check on them and do whatever, but according to what Bob is seeing and what he also heard from John Gott, is that the pattern during the winter, no matter what the temperature is, a pound a week of food. And if you gave them 60 to 80 pounds, as the Merit Guide suggests, they should be okay with this. So how about that for a little tidbit to leave you with? Pretty cool little thing to chew on while you wait for the next episode. So time to say goodbye. Just one last note. Thanks to all those who've been sending in donations. I don't go crazy about asking for this, but I do completely and utterly appreciate any of the donations we receive from the link on our homepage. And thank you for that from the bottom of my heart. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody, and be well.